Well, it was not a good time to be in Egypt and to be Jewish, to be a Hebrew. Just was not a good time. Let's ask the question, why were they there? They'd been there 400 years. That was a long time. You'll remember that there was a famine, and so God took them down to Egypt. They were there 400 years. So what was the point? Did God forget? Oh, crumbs, better go and pick up the kids, as we did once when we were at the optician's. And we realised that we had to be the other side of Leeds. That's where we were living at the time. No, obviously God didn't forget, but God had his purposes and his reasons. So one reason was that when they started off, as we read, they were a group of 70 people. And what God had to do was build that 70 people from that number into a nation. So how was he going to do that? So the first thing was that he used Egypt. So in Egypt, if you like, it became kind of a nursery or an incubator for them to grow and to develop. And that's why you keep reading all the way through. They continue to multiply. They continue to multiply because God was multiplying their numbers. So why couldn't he have done that in Canaan? Well, if you remember, when Abraham was in Canaan, he was a sojourner. He was there. He was tolerated. He was a foreigner. They had respect for Abraham. But had he stayed there, and seeing all those numbers increasing, get bigger and bigger, the Canaanites and those around would have been very uncomfortable, and I believe they would have stopped them. So obviously, by taking them down to Egypt, by making the Egyptians very favourable to the Hebrews, after all, Joseph was the one that saved them, made the nation prosper, that was a place where they could grow as a people, undisturbed, and they had fledgling protection from the Egyptians at that point in time. The second reason God gives us to in Genesis, when he's making these promises to Abraham, he says this: the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet reached its full measure. The iniquity of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. And so that was another reason why they were there 400 years. That you see God's patience waiting, giving the Amorites a possibility to repent and turn. But God knew that it would take 400 years. It would then reach the zenith of its wickedness, or maybe we should say the nadir of its wickedness. So what was the problem there? What was the whole issue? This is what God says in Deuteronomy. You must not worship the Lord your God in the way they do, because in worshipping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters on the fire as sacrifices to their gods. Let no one be found amongst you who sacrifices their sons and daughters to the fire to the fire. Anyone who does this thing is detestable to the Lord. And it's because of these practices the Lord your God will drive them out before you. So you can see that was another major reason why they were down there. And very often the critics will say, oh, wasn't God cruel telling him to wipe out all the people? But you see what these people were like. And that was one of the reasons why God was using the Jewish people to purge them. And of course, God said it the other way around as well. If you don't keep my commandments, you'll be driven out of the land. So God is very even-handed with his people. And I think a third reason, just to test their patience and to test their love for him. Don't forget, Egypt was a pretty magnificent place. And I can imagine conversations maybe like this. Jaime, have you been to Giza yet? No, I haven't been to Giza. Oh, you really should go to Giza. You should see the pyramids. They are magnificent. They're enormous. And they're clad with marble. They are beautiful. This white marble, when the sun shines on it, they gleam. You really should go there. There would have been a temptation to maybe follow some of the Egyptian gods. They were certainly very impressive. Egypt was a very impressive place to be. So maybe one of the reasons God was testing their love for him. But why did they become slaves? Why couldn't he just left them in prosperity? Well, I think the reason's pretty obvious. If he'd not made it hard for the Hebrews, then they probably would have thought, it's quite good here, isn't it? We've got all the pasture we need, we've got room to graze our livestock. Why should we go? And so that's why I think God made them slaves, so that they would want to leave. Although as you follow the story of Exodus, you do wonder that sometimes. So Pharaoh has a plan. He doesn't like the boys. He's concerned about them. You think logically, why didn't he destroy the girls? But no, Pharaoh's got a thing against the males. He's concerned that they will become warriors and fight against him. So plan A, I'll get the Hebrew midwives, the two leaders, Shifra and Pua, and I'll get them to kill the boys. That'll sort it all out. But of course they don't. Oh, Egyptian women, they're just so delicate. But, you know, they're so frail and, oh, they're, you know. But Hebrew women, they're just not likely. They're just not like that. You know, they're tough, they're strong. They're in the fields in the morning getting straw for their husbands. And then, you know, they give birth. And in the afternoon, they're back up there gathering straw again. They just really can't do it. And so that plan failed. And so Pharaoh thinks to himself, well, I've got a plan B. This time, we're going to throw all the baby boys into the Nile. That's brilliant, because don't forget, the Nile was a god to them. We'll throw them all in the Nile. The god Happy will then be pleased. So that was what he was trying to do. But enter two people who the Hebrew writer writes to the Hebrews, and here in the Bible just says parents. But we know, if we actually go on in Exodus chapter 6 and another one in Numbers, we know their names, Amram and Jochebed. That's the name of Moses' parents. And it says in Hebrews chapter 11, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edicts. So really, Moses' faith began with Moses' parents' faith. They're unnamed, as I say, in Hebrews. They're unnamed in the text, but we know their names. But in the eyes of the world, they were nobodies, just ordinary people. The other thing we know about them was that they were Levites. But in God's eyes, in God's plan, in God's purpose, they were far from ordinary. They were special parents. Not only was it not a great time to be in Egypt at that time, it wasn't a great time to get pregnant in Egypt in that time. So you can imagine the conversation. Amram comes in after a hot, sweaty day making bricks, and she says, Amram, I think I might be pregnant again. And I think Amram's heart would have sank. And he'll say, well, are you sure? It's regular as clock. Well, you can set the sundial by me. You know you can. And I've got a stitch as well, just like I did with Miriam and with Aaron. I know I'm pregnant. You can imagine their prayer life from that point on, can't you? They certainly weren't praying for another boy. You can imagine, Lord, please, let's have another daughter. Miriam, she's such a good girl. And they would maybe asking friends and neighbours, can you pray that it's going to be a girl, please? We really don't want a boy. That's going to cause so many problems. And so, of course, a baby is born. And then we read that he was a beautiful child. Now, we all think children are beautiful. Yeah, that's just life. But don't forget, they'd had two before. There was something different that they saw about Moses as a baby. And they needed to see that because they needed faith, which is what the writer of the Hebrews is bringing out. They needed faith to have the courage to hide that child for 3 months, because they would have known that had they been caught hiding a child, they would have been thrown in the Nile as well. And so they needed faith and courage to do that. And I don't know how they did it. Maybe when Moses started to cry as a baby, they gathered around as a family. Right, let's sing choruses, the top of their voice. Come on, we've got to drown out the sound of the baby crying. I don't know. But they hid him for 3 months. They also needed faith, particularly Jochebed needed faith, to actually put Moses in that basket and to put him amongst the bulrushes there in the Nile. And of course, then we come to the next person, and that's Pharaoh's daughter. So she's coming down. And let's not forget whose daughter she was. This is Pharaoh's daughter. No one else's daughter. This is Pharaoh's daughter. She's going down. They've got baths in Egypt. She's going down to worship. And Jochebed knows that. But let's remember, when she finds this baby, it could have gone either way. She could have said, fathers said, any Hebrew boys, we're going to throw them in the Nile. That's easy. She could have done that. There was no guarantee or anything other than she could have done that. But she chose to ignore her father's wishes. And not only that, she was probably the only person in Egypt that could have guaranteed Moses' safety as a baby. After all, she was Pharaoh's daughter. If there was anyone that had threatening that child, Jochebed simply had to say to that person, go and have a chat with Pharaoh's palace there and just check it out. If you want to risk throwing out Pharaoh's son, that's up to you. And so that would have been protection, complete immunity for Moses as he was growing up. And the best part of all was that Pharaoh paid for it. It wasn't her money. She was spending daddy's money. And so Pharaoh paid for it. You can just see the way that God works here. Aha. But let's not overlook Miriam, because her part in this is also very important. She was incredibly courageous when she went up to Pharaoh. She was a slave girl, don't forget. And the conversation didn't go like this. Hi, Princey. We've not been introduced, but I'm Miriam, by the way. Wonderful gown you've got there. I just always love the way you dress. Couldn't help noticing you just found a baby. The look so suits you. You're going to make a great mother. I tell you what, I can see you're not really quite ready for bringing up a young baby. Do you want me to go and see if I can find a Hebrew woman? Get a good deal for you. She'll bring the child up. It didn't go like that, but just imagine the courage that she needed as a slave girl to go up to the princess and say, do you want me to find someone to nurse this child for you? So don't forget Miriam's part in all of this. And you can see the way that God works in human planning, can't you? Because Jochebed didn't just randomly put Moses in that basket, in that place. She knew the princess came down to worship every day. She knew the time, approximately, and she knew the place. So Jochebed used her intelligence and she put baby Moses in that basket at the right place, at the right time. And she knew also to station Miriam there. But of course, all of that planning could have come to absolutely nothing unless God was stepping in, because it was God that changed Pharaoh's daughter's heart and made her love that child. So you have to, but you can see the way that God was working with human planning, and that's what he's like. How long did Moses was nursed for? Some people say 12 years. Some people say 4 or 5 years. We don't really know. It's not stated. Opinions are varied. But I think it's unlikely that the princess would have wanted to go through potty training and, oh, he's had an accident again. So I think it might have been 12 years. And I just think, wow, isn't that perfect? She has him from a baby, takes him all the way up to 12 years of age, and then just as he's going to become a teenager, off he goes. And he's sent to Pharaoh. Just brilliant, brilliant. But God noticed these things. And I think God thought to himself, oh, Pharaoh, you seem to have a problem with Hebrew males. That's interesting. That's interesting. Don't you think that the women are a danger to you as well, Pharaoh? And I just love the way he does this. So we've got two Hebrew midwives. We've got Jochebed herself. We've got Miriam, her daughter. And then to really rub salt in the wounds, we've got Pharaoh's own daughter. And those five women humiliate and thwart the whole plans of Pharaoh. And my last school was the girls' grammar school. You don't have to tell me how brilliant, how clever, how intelligent women are. And I really know that. And remember Kipling's poem? Probably you don't, because I never did, but I was looking it up. Kipling said, the female of the species is more deadly than the male. And that was a song as well. I won't make half of you feel really old and the other thing, well, because some of you there, particularly over here where the younger people tend to sit, you're thinking, oh, yeah, that was a song. Yeah, I remember that one when I was a child. And the adults over here are thinking, yeah, I remember that song. It wasn't that long ago, was it? It was 1996. Ah, yes, okay. But Jochebed was an amazing mother. Don't forget, she had Miriam, she had Aaron, and both these people were spiritual leaders in Israel. Miriam was the first prophetess, and Aaron was the first high priest. So they were very important people. She brought them up. Moses had been taught by Jochebed. So I think Jochebed would have taught them about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, would have taught them that God had promised to make them a great nation, would have taught them that God promised to bring them into their own land. He would have promised to take them out of slavery, as he promised to Abraham, and bring them back. So Jochebed would have filled Moses with all this excitement, and that's what carried him through, all that indoctrination. I don't know what it was like at school. I don't know what sort of child he was, but I can imagine he was a bit difficult in RE lessons. And I can imagine it. So, okay, the teacher standing at the front there. Okay, right, where did we finish off last week? Okay, who can tell me who killed the god Osiris? Yes, Aten. Yes, that's right. It was Set. Set killed the god Osiris. Okay, Moses, I can see you got your hand up again. Okay, how can Osiris be a god if he ends up getting killed? Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, but your people, your historic people, because you know you're one of us, Moses, your people believe in this one God. I mean, how ridiculous is that? How can one God be in command of the sun, the stars, the moon, the heavens, the rain, the weather, the rivers, the mountains, illnesses, all the... How can one God be responsible for all of that? Because he's God. Okay, Moses, I do find you difficult. Can I be honest with you? I'll tell you what. What's that? Who do I personally love? Who's my favourite God? I don't love any God, Moses. I just try and keep my head down. I don't want to upset them and annoy them. But, okay, Moses, tell you this. I bet you one day you'll meet one of our gods. And let's say it's a ball of fire you'll meet him in. When you do, Moses, you ask him. You say to him, okay, what's your name? And I bet you, Moses, he says, my name is Shemet. I am the God of fire. Okay, difficult child. But of course, that's our responsibility, isn't it? Teaching our children about God. We encourage our children. You know, we certainly did as parents. We encouraged them at school. We encouraged them perhaps to be musical. We encouraged them to be sporting, to be well-rounded people. But I sometimes wonder what happens if they become a professor, but they don't gain saving faith. And I think that's the role of the parent, to do all we can in that. As it says in Proverbs, start children off on the way they should go, and even when they're old, they will not depart from it. And further on in the Bible, it says this. So we're reading in Deuteronomy chapter 6, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And then it says, impress upon your children. Talk to them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Does that sound like everywhere and anywhere to you? Because it does to me. So God is saying, bring up your children, talk to them. Talk to them about me. So love God and teach your children. Now, we all know that our own walk with God has to be real. We have to share what God has done. That's really what God expects of us. So when something amazing has happened in your life, maybe at work, whatever, you've given an opportunity, do you share that with your children? Do you say to them, something really incredible happened today? If you've had even your daily quiet time and you suddenly feel that God's had a breakthrough, or you've had a breakthrough with God, do you feel at that point maybe it's something you can share with your children? We should talk to them. If you can, have a family worship time together. That's really something that we did when we were small children. We had a family worship time with them. We had a Bible story, and we really... That was something that was important to us. That was before I fell away. But let's be honest with ourselves. Life necessarily isn't like Proverbs 22:6, is it? And so we have to ask the question, what happens if some of our children do fall away, if they do go cold? So I've got 10 points, very brief points, which I wanted to share with you. Some of them are blatantly obvious. Some of them, just maybe one of them, you might find useful. So here you go. Number one, obvious thing, but remember that to always be a safe space for your children. Though they might have rejected God, don't, in your body language, in the way you talk to them, never make them feel that you've rejected them. Number two, don't use your pain as a weapon against them. Don't try and make them feel guilty about it. Don't blame yourself, number three. Don't beat yourself up about it. Is God trying to say something in this situation? But don't blame yourself. At the same time, though, don't blame God, number four. He's the one, after all, they've rejected. How do you think God feels about that, the hurt that he feels? You can provide love for them, number five, but you cannot provide their faith. That's something which only God can provide. And so I don't feel that you have failed. Number six, don't nag or browbeat them if they talk to you about it. Empathize with them. Try and share with them. Share times in your life when you find things difficult. Let them know that where they feel now and where they are now is not necessarily going to be the end, where they're going to end up. Seven, accept the fact that you might just be the very last person to talk, they want to talk to about God. I know this was something that Catherine found very difficult because I did not want to talk to her about faith. And just be aware of the fact that maybe children don't want to talk to you because they might feel, well, if I talk to mum and dad about it, I'll hurt them. Just be aware of that. Number eight, obviously don't give up praying for them, never did. It took over 30 years of Catherine's prayer to bring me back and other people's prayer. But nine, always remember that it's Jesus that goes and saves and seeks those. It's Jesus that goes after, in Matthew's gospel, those that have wandered away. And it says he comes back rejoicing, not scolding, but rejoicing. And finally, just consider this. Jochebed was perhaps 20 when she had Moses. He spent 40 years being trained in the ways of the Egyptians, so now she's 60. And then Moses flees Egypt. He's away for 40 years. Can you imagine how she felt? All those expectations, all those plans, Moses flees in shame. And it's 40 years, so now she's 100. Maybe she never saw Moses come back and free the children. Maybe she died not wondering, not knowing what was going on. But just remember that God always has an overview, a plan. We might not always see this, but God's got his plan. But let me turn this around a bit more positive, because we've been a bit mundane. When you look at Moses, and I cleared this with Oz, because Oz is teaching. When you look at the life of Moses, there is one thing that really impresses me. And it's the same with Abraham. These are the two men that are called friends of God. And I just think that's absolutely wonderful. Friends of God. Just let that sink in. The creator of the entire universe, the most powerful being that ever existed, this incredible, all self-sustaining God, needs nothing, wanted Moses to be his friend. So what does friendship look like? Well, friends confide in each other. And I love the way that he does this with Abraham. He's going to go and destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And God thinks to himself, shall I hide what I'm going to do from Abraham? After all, he's going to be the father of the nation. He's going to bring the children up. I'll let him into what I'm going to do. You see the way that God confines. Friends, they share their woes. Does God share his woes? Did he share his woes with Moses? Again, in Deuteronomy, we see the children of Israel have one of those periods when they come back. Oh, sorry, we're really sorry. We'll obey you. We're pretty sorry about this. And God's turning to Moses and he says, oh, that their hearts would be inclined to fear me and my commands always. And isn't that just like us sometimes if we've got children that are a bit naughty and someone says, oh, they were well behaved today. And we say, oh, if only they would be like this all the time. And this is what God is sharing with Moses. If only they'd be like this all the time, then they'd be so blessed and their children would be so blessed. Friends like each other's company. And it goes on. God says to Moses, okay, tell them to go back to their tents. And then he says, but you stay here with me. And I think there's a pretext here. God says, you stay here with me. Pretext, I'll give the rest of the laws and commands you want to pass on. But I just love that. God says, you stay here with me. God just loved being in Moses' presence. And sometimes friends, they want to be alone, though they tell us they want to be alone. But that's not always the case. And if the incident with the golden calf, God is really furious about this. And he says to Moses, now leave me alone so that I may go and destroy these people. I just can't tell you how angry I am with them. And Moses, I'm going to make you the great nation. And Moses then turns to God and he says, do you mind if I say something about, I'm not sure it's the really great idea, Lord. If you do that, the Egyptians are going to say, oh, that's why he took them out of Egypt, so he could take them into the wilderness to destroy them. Well, we didn't like them that much either, did we? So God couldn't have done that. I don't think that's a great look. And remember, you made that promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Don't get me wrong, I'm really flattered. But Lord, we know that you keep your promises. Should we rethink this? And obviously God does, and he changes his mind. And I think God says, oh, Moses, do you know how much that really touches my heart, that you're turning all this down? Of course, God knew that he would anyway. And it's just the love that he has there. Friends are honest and frank with each other. And at one point, God says, look, okay, we're going to go up to the promised land. I really, really, really can't go with you because I'm just so fed up with these people. I'm going to send an angel instead. He'll go with you. He'll sort it all out. And Moses basically says, if you're not going, I'm not going. He puts it in more polite words than that, but that's basically what he's saying. If you're not going, I'm not going. And how do you think that made God feel? God says to Moses, okay, I'll go with you, Moses. Don't worry. I think that really blessed God. And friends can be demanding, finally, with each other. And Moses says at one point, yeah, we've known each other a long time now. Can I see your glory? And God says, oh, Moses, I'd love to, but there's a bit of a problem with that. If I show you my glory, you'll just go poof, you'll just evaporate. I can't really do that. But what I will do, I'll put my hand over you, cleft in a rock, and I'll let you see a bit of my glory, knowing obviously that one day God would say, actually, Moses, you're going to see my glory. You're going to go back to a mountain, and you're going to see my son. So, when you look at that depth of relationship, do you think to yourself, I wish I had that depth of relationship? Do you think, I really wish that I could be a friend of God like that? Some of you I know are already ahead of me because you're already in John's gospel and you're already listening to the words that Jesus said. I no longer call you servants because servants don't know what their master's doing, but I call you friends. And God calls us friends. Just let that sink in. God says that to us, the creator, the master of the universe. He says to us, I want you to be my friend. He says to us, look, let's look at your life together. Let me come in alongside. Let me help you fix it. Let's fix it up. Let's put this right. So have you arrived at that place in your life where God is your friend? Or are you still sitting there thinking, well, I've heard a lot about it, but I'm not sure I'm ready yet? As Richard said, don't leave here this morning if you're in that position. Don't leave here. Talk to Oz, talk to James, talk to them about what it means to become a friend of God. Though, if you do know Jesus, how do you develop this relationship with him? I promise I'm coming to a close. Sorry, we're a bit tight on time this morning. If we have a knowledge of Jesus, how do we deepen that relationship with him? And I think we have to say, well, really, you're as close to Jesus as you want to be. You're as close to Jesus as you can be. Let me ask you a few questions, personal questions. What do you make time for in terms of leisure? We prioritize our leisure. Do we prioritize time for Jesus? Do we carve out time for him? Or are we just getting by? You see, I think God really enjoyed being in Moses' presence. Don't forget, when he was talking to Moses about all the wickedness, God had to watch that. God had to see every child that was thrown into the fire. God has to see every murder, every mugging, every child abuse, every rape. God has to see that today. And I kind of think God likes coming into our presence because, I'm not going to say safe space, God doesn't need a safe space, but it's a nice place for him to be. God wants to spend time with you because he loves you and he knows that in your presence, he can fellowship with you. So Jesus is looking forward to spending time with you. So how do you deepen that relationship? Obviously through worship, immersing in his word. And I can't tell you how wonderful his word is. If you think, but the Bible's a really difficult book, ask Oz, ask James. They'll help you how to get into it. It's not an easy book, I'll acknowledge that. But it's a wonderful book. Structure your prayer. Okay, so let's close taking a leaf, I promise you, taking a leaf out of Moses' book. Moses had a tent of meeting, and it says in Exodus 33, now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away. And people would come to him with his problems, but then it says, the Lord would speak to Moses there face to face, as one speaks to a friend. So Moses went away by himself where God would speak to him. And that's in the New Testament as well. Jesus said, but when you pray, go into your room. And when you've shut the door, pray to your Father who is in secret place. And your Father who sees you will reward you openly. So let me ask you, where is your tent of meeting? Where do you meet with God each day? Thank you.